the vast, vast majority of our health outcomes come down to what you do every single day, and it's your habits that matter, and you are absolutely in control of that.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so excited about our guest today. He is simply brilliant. His name is Dr. Ryan Williamson. He's a board-certified neurologist, Navy veteran, and the founder of Transcend Health, a performance longevity practice dedicated to helping individuals live longer, healthier, and have more impactful lives. After commissioning as an officer in the U.S. Navy, Dr. Williamson completed his medical education at the Florida State University College of Medicine, followed by a neurology residency at Georgetown University Hospital. Motivated by limitations he witnessed in traditional sick care, Dr. Williamson committed his career to prevention, cognitive health, and high performance medicine. Through Transcend Health, he integrates neuroscience, lifestyle medicine, and executive coaching to help leaders, entrepreneurs, and purpose-driven individuals optimize their brain, body, and longevity. He's also the author of the best-selling book, The Incredible Brain, A Guide to Preserving Cognitive Function, Improving Performance, and Extending Health Span. There is so much I'm excited to talk to you about today. Dr. Ryan Williamson, MD, welcome to the Daily Helping. It is amazing to have you with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Schuster. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited. You're excited. We're excited. So, you know, we teased a little bit of your background, certainly that you're a former Navy officer. But I love, because you're doing something so unique, I love finding out people's superhero origin stories. Take us back in the Ryan Williamson time machine and talk to us about kind of these seminal moments that put you on the path you're on today.
I think, like many people that feel called to healthcare, I experienced early loss in my life, and that informed my desire to go into medicine. In fact, some of my earliest memories, as sad as this may be, are at funerals of my family members. I mean, I remember my grandmother's funeral when I was 5, sitting on my mom's lap, looking up at her, wondering why she was crying. I mean, this is like literally the first memories I have. And that got gears turning, you know, not to dwell on the sadness, but, you know, that really just made me question, what is life and why do people get sick or why do bad things happen? And that was a recurrent theme with several other family members early in my life. And one of those was my grandfather, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's before I was born. And my memories of him are just of being confined to a wheelchair, essentially. He was just so stiff from the disease. And ultimately, that shaped my desire to pursue neurology. And anyway, fast forward, I get through medical school and go through my training. I commissioned in the Navy as part of that. I always wanted to serve. That's a whole other parallel track, I suppose. But I honestly didn't realize until getting out of the military, which was just a few years ago, how much I enjoyed keeping people healthy and working with healthy people, and how much performance medicine is inherent to the military, because my job is literally to keep Marines and sailors, you know, battlefield ready. And getting back into the civilian hospitals, and you know, here I am seeing people that are coming in with late stage Parkinson's, and I'm diagnosing dementia like Alzheimer's, trying to put out emergencies by treating acute strokes. You know, that in its own regard is gratifying to help people through these emergencies and terrible situations. But when you look at the medical literature, and when we look at really what's available to us all today, we can do so much better if we just rewind the clock a handful of years and get people on the right path. And that, I figured out, is where my passion is. And so I've since decided to write this book and create Transcend Health and totally pivot away from the reactive medical model that specialists, you know, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners are familiar with, practice in. And that's that, you know, I don't ever get a phone call until there's an emergency in my traditional role as a neurologist. And I think we owe it to society to do better.
What's interesting about that, so there's a couple of things you said were, one was striking to me. You figured out that you just love helping people, right? Like be healthy. And it just seems intuitive that every doctor should be there. But you know, I know that the system that we have, particularly in the West, is set up in such a way that it's just not like that. And so that you have figured out this roadmap, which is preventative and proactive, is fantastic. We only get one brain, right? Like if we bust a hip or break a limb, like we can put plates in and we can replace hips. We can even replace hearts. We're not replacing brains, not anytime soon. And so, you know, usually when I have a best-selling author on such as yourself, my next question, you know, leads to, well, why did you feel you had to write this book? But you kind of answered that, right? You felt compelled to write The Incredible Brain because cognitive health is so essential to longevity and performance. And so, you know, we had a very brief chat before we hit the record button. And, you know, an area that you and I are both very focused on and interested in is kind of this dichotomy that we live in, because from a neurobiological standpoint, we have these evolutionary aspects of our brain that are millions of years old, essentially. Yet we're living in a society where we're doing things that are counterintuitive in terms of brain health and that are really making us unwell. So I'd love to spend some time there. Let's talk about that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when we rewind the clock, I mean, not even very far. I mean, we're talking, you know, just really a few decades or maybe even 100 or more years ago, life was very different for us as humans. And that was really, you know, the case for hundreds of thousands of years prior to that. And when we look at the circumstances under which our brains and our bodies evolved, very different than the rapid social evolution that we've experienced in the last few decades. And to kind of paint that picture, I like to think about, okay, what did our average ancestor do? You know, they woke up with the sun. They're probably a little hungry. They're probably a little cold. If it was, you know, they were in a northern climate, they got moving. They tried to go find some food, which required physical activity. Maybe they found something. Maybe they didn't. You know, certainly they weren't able to reach into the pantry or just, you know, drive over to Costco, right? To go find some version of whole organic foods. Maybe they didn't find anything. Maybe they went to sleep hungry. You know, but at the end of the day, they got back together in a tribe-like community after probably a hard day's work of some sort of physical labor movement, and then slept well without much stress, minus the occasional predator, and then woke up and did it all over again. And to state the obvious, our life today is nothing like that. I mean, here you and I are in different states communicating across this amazing technological platform, you know, that the Zoom world has become, right? Over high-speed internet, staring at screens, but we're both comfortable. We're indoors in a climate-controlled environment. I'm standing because I have a standing desk, but most of the time we sit, right? We don't move a lot. We have limited physical activity. Food is abundant and convenient. In many cases, we consume far more calories than we need relative to our expenditure. We're constantly stressed. I mean, there's even a whole conversation around light. I mean, even as I sit in my studio with these artificial lights, about how short wavelength light is perhaps not as good for us as we thought relative to getting outside and experiencing more long wavelength light. And the list goes on. But our modern society does not set us up for success with respect to cognitive and or physical health at the individual level. I mean, that saps performance. That robs us of our ability to be fully present with people we love and care about if we're stressed out all the time and not functioning well. And in the long term, I mean, this really contributes to a shortened health span and a shortened lifespan when we don't optimize for the machine that is us. And I mean, we could go any number of directions with that, from the social to economic implications to just quality of life and happiness. But this is a real crisis, in my opinion, and it's one that's very fixable and very simple.
Yet nobody's talking about it.
Correct.
So you and I are talking about it, but you don't hear initiatives from state or federal governments talking about, what can we do? Yeah, I mean, yes, your iPhone or your Android device has an option where you can toggle the blue light spectrum of light off after sundown, and that's important. But, you know, we're going to look back on today, decades from now, with data, and we're really going to see how harmful, not just to our well-being and happiness, but I mean, our executive functioning, our cardiovascular functioning, our neurological function, just how much harm we're doing to ourselves. And I think, you know, technology plays a large role in that. Like you said, you know, we don't have predators out there, but yet we've enabled these little devices we hold in our hands to be, you know, releasing cortisol 24/7 because social media stresses us out about something, whether it's, you know, hurricanes or war or politics, whatever it is, the algorithm knows how to rile you up because you'll be more engaged. And that's not tinfoil hat conspiracy thinking. That's the reality. These are platforms designed, they make money based on engagement. The more engaged you are, the more likely you're going to scroll through an ad. And so, you know, I always tell people when I'm on a stage or I'm on TV, I say, the next time you go to dinner, put your cell phone in your pocket and you can't cheat with your Apple Watch. And if you can get through that whole meal without having any urge to look at your phone and grab it and see who messaged you or what popped up in your X feed, congratulations to you. I'm willing to bet that most people can't do it. And that's indicative of a really large problem.
Absolutely. And I learned that myself the hard way, at least in terms of alert or decision fatigue. But when I was stationed at Camp Lejeune, which is a big Marine Corps base on the East Coast of the U.S., there were times where I was the only neurologist on base. And so there were times where I was essentially on call 24/7, which is not sustainable for anybody who doesn't know much about provider call schedules. That is like unheard of in the civilian world and miserable. And my pager would go off so often that, I mean, literally let's put it this way. When I got out of the military, my systolic blood pressure dropped 15 points because I was able to at least put the pager down. I mean, I was constantly on this high alert because, again, if the pager went off, this was, you know, somebody's having a stroke or they're having a seizure. I mean, it's really an emergent problem that I would have to go, you know, drive into the hospital to deal with, not to mention the interruptions in my sleep and just chronic stress levels overall. But this idea that we're tied to devices, to your point, it's deleterious to our health. And, you know, when we look at the algorithms on social media, as you mentioned, the average adult attention span today is 8.25 seconds. And now that I've been more public facing and I'm creating more content on these platforms to try to help educate people, when I look at the engagement with my videos, that matches. I mean, somebody, you know, watches me for 8 seconds and boom, they're on to the next thing. And you and I both know that our brain is this just supercomputer, and all it's doing is decoding and processing inputs to give you outputs. But when you train yourself to have a limited attention span and only consume something for a period of a few seconds and constantly feel that anxiety or that need to pick up the device and check it and look at this platform and who messaged me and all of those things, you're training your brain to anticipate more of that. So you're literally rewiring the structure of your brain to want, need, and crave more of that. And I mean, you forget about trying to get through a podcast or watch a movie or any sort of long form content or have a meaningful conversation with someone at dinner. Your brain is not equipped to do those things, which is what it's designed to do. And anyway, it's an interesting problem, isn't it?
It is, but I'm excited because we teased as we were talking about the incredible brain that we could fix these things. These are things that we can fix. So I think we've probably sufficiently riled people up and scared them. Let's talk about what somebody listening to this can do to start improving their cognitive health and undo some of this damage that society is just by proxy of being around all of this has kind of forced upon us.
Absolutely. So there, when I look at, you know, what's helpful, I try to approach this from an evidence-based paradigm, meaning, you know, what does the medical literature tell us? What do we have evidence for? Rather than what the next influencer on social media is trying to promote or tell you, because as Dr. Schuster and I both know, being in this space, it's a little frustrating to see people who maybe don't have the credentials or the training who espouse that you should be doing A, B, or C. And oh, by the way, they usually have a product to sell at the end of that. So there's an easy decision filter for you when listening. Consider who is telling you the information and are they trying to sell you something? That usually is very telling, in my opinion. But in either case, when we look at the medical evidence, there are a handful of things, and I have put together what I call the BRAIN protocol. So BRAIN being the acronym. And they're each of these sort of pillars of our health that I like to think about. And we can run through a couple of these or all of them, depending on the time we have. But to start with letter B, this is perhaps the easiest thing that people can do, and that's basic breath work or breathing. And I mean, if people just take the time to engage in mindful, dedicated breathing for 5 to 20 minutes a day, which is not that long, and it's easy to get into, not only does that help you get out of that acute stress state in the moment, but it actually rewires your brain to anticipate more control over your what's called your prefrontal cortex, which is the part up front that we use for our highest order functioning. And it actually downregulates the connections to the amygdala or the fear center, which keeps us riled up and in that fight or flight sort of short attention mode. So again, just like watching and consuming stressful short form content where you're scroll, that's pushing you in the wrong direction. By putting the phone down and doing just guided breathing or just guided meditation, that actually allows more connections or stronger connections to the prefrontal cortex and allows you to get out of the stress state and to be able to engage more meaningfully with people, to think at a higher level and a higher function. And again, there's good science behind this, and that's 100% free. That's all you have to do is just implement the protocol.
I love that. And there's pretty good evidence in the literature that as you increase breathing and then you're oxygenating that, as you said, that prefrontal cortex, it lets us be more focused. It lets us think more clearly. There's just so many benefits of doing breathing that go beyond just physiological things we can measure by looking at real-time cortical blood flow. So I love that B is the first one we started with. What about the R?
Yeah, so R is for rest. So when I say rest, this is all things sleep-related, recovery. And I think, you know, I work with a lot of high performers, entrepreneurs. Certainly when I was in the military, this was an issue for everybody. But I think sleep is a place where people feel like they can, you know, kind of make up some ground or skip rest. Because again, we all require 7.5 to 9 hours in a 24-hour cycle. And if you've got a deadline coming up and you're, I don't know, you're like Dr. Schuster and I, and you're trying to write a book or or whatever busy project you have at work, when you think about, man, I could get 2 more hours of work done and I can just eat into my sleep a little bit, that's an easy place to pick that up. Well, again, I think that's the wrong attitude for a lot of reasons. Number one, we've all experienced poor sleep or restless sleep, and we know how we feel the following day. We feel pretty awful. So that's an immediate performance killer. So not a good strategy if you're just interested in being effective day to day, number one. But number two, when we look at our brain health and we look at our long-term health, sleep is pretty darn important. And in fact, sleep is the only time that your brain forms new memories after you listen to a podcast or read a book or you're taking classes, whatever, right? So you got to have quality sleep to form new memories. But not only that, it regulates your immune function. It's the only time that your muscles repair themselves after intense workouts. In fact, exercise helps you achieve better quality sleep. So there's a little hack too. But I mean, it literally, sleep impacts every bodily system. And perhaps when we look at long-term brain function, one of the most relevant here is a function of the brain, or at least a system within the brain called the glymphatic system. It's a relatively new discovery over the last decade and a half. I believe it was 2012. This was finally identified, which is interesting anatomically for Dr. Schuster and I, who've assumed that we pretty much had anatomy worked out. Apparently we didn't. But for those of you who've ever had a cold or a virus and you have, you know, your lymph nodes in your neck get swollen, this is kind of the same thing, but in the brain. So like lymph nodes, but glymphatic with a G. And it's this washing machine that's in your brain that sort of clears out all this metabolic debris that accumulates throughout the day. And it's chiefly active during sleep. Why does that matter? Well, one of those metabolites that accumulates is a protein called amyloid or beta amyloid. And we know that over time, this is one of the two pathologic hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common cause of dementia. And so if we're not clearing that amyloid out day by day, you know, if you're a young person listening to this or watching this, you know, perhaps you're not going to notice it over a period of months or years. But fast forward a few decades, I mean, this is a huge divergence in people who we think go on to develop dementia and those who are at lower risk, among other interventions. So sleep is imperative, and it's more, I mean, we anyway, I could talk for hours on this.
Well, I want to ask you a question because there has been, I won't call it a movement, but you know, you've talked about influencers saying X, Y, and Z for your health. There are a lot of people out there who will tell you that the 7 to 9 hours is nonsense and you can use polyphasic sleep, which means sleeping for these brief periods of time and just end up getting 4 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period and hack it so that you can have the same quality of sleep as a regular 7 to 9 hour monophasic sleep cycle. So I'd love for you to dispel that.
Yeah, I would argue that there's no quality data that actually affirms that. And again, we look at the way our biology operates. Perhaps many of you've heard of this term, but there's something we call our circadian rhythm, and it's the sort of relative 24-hour cycle. It's actually 24 hours and 20 or 30 minutes or so. So it's a little longer than 24 hours, but almost every body system that runs your machine, is responsive to this system. And if we don't respect that balance, meaning that if we're not intentionally awake and focused and running during the day, and then not resting at night for all these reparative functions to happen, we know that long term, again, there's an elevated risk of cancer, for example. There's an elevated risk of cardiometabolic disease, so like increased risk of heart attacks and strokes, increased risk of things like diabetes, high blood pressure, sleep apnea. So to have fragmented sleep, I mean, can you make up for sleep debt or at least get through your day and function? Yeah, I suppose that it could help, or at least it could help buffer some of that. And there's some interventions that also seem to help. If you're feeling jet lagged or tired, like you can take a high dose of creatine that can kind of push you through, or a stimulant like a caffeine or a sympathomimetic medication. But those are all band-aids. Those are all temporary fixes. And really, the only way that we can naturally optimize our health with respect to that circadian rhythm and our biology is to achieve quality, regular sleep, or regular quality sleep, maybe the better way to say that. And there's another study, or at least series of studies. I think these are papers came out in 2013, if I'm not mistaken. But interesting data that was pulled from the state of Michigan that actually looked at the difference in hospital admission rates around daylight savings time. So they looked at the fall back, where we gain an hour, and spring forward, we lose the hour. I know we all just experienced fall back if you're in a daylight saving state, which is most of them at this point. Fall back, we all tend to feel better, we get extra rest. Okay, fine. So that data seems fairly neutral. So it's either no change or maybe slight benefit in terms of health outcomes. But we look at the spring forward data. This is where it gets interesting. So they looked at, again, admission rates for acute coronary syndrome. So that's chest pain related to a heart attack. And even actually admission for stroke, so for which is basically a heart attack of the brain, both of which can be damaging and/or lethal. And there's about a 25% increased presentation or incidence of people coming to the ER for chest pain that was concerning for a heart attack when they lost an hour of sleep. And you might think, why in the world is this? Well, it has to do with this circadian rhythm, and because there's that much additional strain and activation of that fight or flight or that sympathetic nervous system that elevates blood pressure, squeezes blood vessels. Now, to be clear, these were largely in people who had pre-existing risk factors. So don't go thinking if you're a healthy 20-year-old with zero health issues is going to be you. Probably not. But in somebody who's middle-aged or older, who maybe has a little high blood pressure or diabetes, or they've got some narrowed coronary vessels, this could be the difference in a major health outcome by losing an hour of sleep. And again, it's very rare that we get that many people on the same sleep schedule that we can actually measure this across a population, which is why I think this is so interesting. But it proves the point here that, I mean, this is detrimental to our health if we do not respect this long term.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I'd never heard that study. I am familiar with an unrelated, if not mildly ridiculous, study that showed that psychiatric hospital admissions significantly increase every time there's a full moon. So make of that whatever you will. But it makes sense, what you're talking about with respect to the circadian rhythm being interrupted. So you basically laid out everything I ever wanted anybody to hear about sleep. So thank you for so eloquently articulating that. So we've got the B is breathing, the R is rest. Dr. Ryan, what's the A?
A is for activity. And so when I think about activity, this is everything movement and exercise related. And I think this one unfortunately has the most unnecessary resistance tag to it because people overcomplicate it. And I think a lot of people maybe are afraid that, oh, I've never lifted weights before, or they're intimidated if they walk into a gym, or maybe they're, you know, worried about their body or their appearance. And I completely understand and empathize with all of that. But when I talk about movement, I mean, this is really simple. So I briefly mentioned this earlier, but I don't have a chair in my office because I designed my workspace to integrate movement into my day. So I like to stand when I do podcasts or when I read. For that matter, I've got a little under desk treadmill that I turn on, just a little walking pad that I got on Amazon for like $200. I mean, so yeah, maybe out of the price range for some, but it's not crazy expensive when we look at what a year's worth of a gym membership might be. So I turn that on and I can get my 10,000 steps in a day while I'm working, just low grade. My point in saying this is they're very easy ways to purposefully integrate movement into your day that, when we look at the literature, have a massive impact on our overall health. Just when we look at the caloric balance, so that intake versus movement, we all have a daily energy need that we have. And if we just stand, you actually burn about 50 more calories an hour than you do if you're sitting by contracting your anti-gravity muscles. So you get an extra calorie burn that way by just standing up. If you start walking, my goodness, when we look at, you know, the 8,000 to 10,000 step range a day, I mean, big studies, I think the British Medical Journal last year had the last look at this. But there's about a 38% or 40% reduction in all-cause mortality for people that just walk 8,000 to 10,000 steps a day compared to those that don't. And that means the risk of dying of anything, for those that are not familiar. That's a massive intervention for just walking, just moving every day. And if there was ever any doubt that humans are designed to move, I mean, this, like, just study after study proves this. We have to move. And, you know, back to that initial, you know, kind of picture we painted about our ancestors, you know, waking up and being a little chilly and having to go walk and find food. This is how we're designed. It's just that simple. And when we sit, it causes massive problems. So from there, you know, we can build in resistance training. We can build in cardiovascular and endurance training, because those absolutely move the needle. You know, we look at the longevity data around hand grip strength. So it's not just that you can squeeze something. It's just a reflection of what that means in terms of your, you know, being able to push and pull and lift things. Same thing with, you know, dedicated, you know, low intensity cardiovascular work, that elevates a measurement called our VO2 max, which is how efficiently our bodies extract oxygen from our lungs and into our bloodstream. So there are ways we can measure this physiologically. And we look at people that have higher VO2 max versus low, or higher hand grip strength versus low. These people actually live longer and they live in better health. So the point is, we've got to move and we've got to integrate this into our day if we want to live long, healthy lives. And I mean, sleep's probably number two, but exercise or movement's got to be number one for me. And we look at the actual strength of data on this.
I've read pretty compelling literature that your VO2 max and your strength are two of the most predictive factors for longevity.
There's no question. There's no question. And both decline with age, and they can be maintained with the right protocols. So very, very fixable for many people.
Awesome. So we've got BRA. What is I?
So I is intake. So we're back to that caloric balance again. So this is all things nutrition and supplement related. And this is one perhaps where I think, you know, people maybe miss the forest for the trees, or at least, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, whether it's the influencer or the government crowd that hones in on red dye, or whether something's processed or ultra processed. I mean, those things matter probably, but the macro view here, in my opinion, is making sure that we look at dietary principles. So, you know, there are all these camps out there. I mean, there's, you know, there's keto, there's carnivore, there's vegan, vegetarian, paleo, excuse me. I could go on and on. And I think, you know, certain camps get certain things right. But perhaps they might miss others. So again, we look at the data in terms of our longevity. Really, two categories of diet seem to help the most with our long-term brain health and body health. And that would be either a plant-based diet or a Mediterranean diet. And if either of those sound horrible, I assure you they are not. That doesn't mean that you can't eat meat. It just means that whatever your base is has to be consistent with one of these categories. And focusing on, again, an adequate protein intake, focusing on the right amount of fiber, focusing on the right amount of healthy fat. Fat's got a bad rap in the 90s, which is a whole other thing. This stuff seems to move in cycles. I would argue that the kind of the standard American diet, which also spells sad, which I also think is funny, is we consume way too many calories. It's very carbohydrate heavy. So lots of processed sugars, breads, that kind of thing, which again is just an excess. So we tend to, you know, not have enough of the healthy fat and the protein, too much of the carbs, and that leads to a lot of the weight gain and the metabolic issues that we see. So anyway, getting that balance and the macronutrients right, making sure we balance that with the right micronutrients, which are the vitamins and minerals that our cellular machinery actually needs to run effectively and help repair itself. And then again, this is back to the activity slash intake balance, but you know, making sure that we have that in check and that people are educated on what their actual caloric needs are, just at a, on a high level. You could eat the most stringent or strict plant-based or Mediterranean diet in the world, but if you consume five times the amount of calories you need, you're going to gain weight, and that's going to cause problems. So people need to understand, at least at a basic level, how to plan for that. And when we do, again, our health outcomes are, people live longer. I mean, whether it's caloric restriction or intermittent fasting, I mean, there are different ways to get there, or just, putting food on smaller plates. I mean, there's some really easy techniques people can implement, but we can't skip this one. And again, we look at the rates of obesity in America. I mean, 74% of U.S. adults are overweight or obese, and that trend is only growing. 93% of us have metabolic dysfunction, which means that we don't have optimal levels of blood pressure, blood sugar, triglycerides, fats in the bloodstreams, and abdominal circumference. I mean, these lead to serious problems over time. And again, it's fixable with just some basic interventions.
You've named some statistics about Americans in particular. I think about Europeans, because as you were talking about bread, I mean, we all like bread. I think there's a difference between a loaf of bread you get at your grocery store versus these whole grain kind of breads from an actual baker, or making your own, with organic whole wheat flour or sourdough, because the European diet, which I guess that's largely Mediterranean in a lot of places, right? That's where it gets its name. There's a ton of bread, but it's not like Wonder Bread, right? So what's the big difference?
Correct. Yeah. So I'm not a nutritionist or a dietitian. I should probably lead with that. So somebody may pick this apart. So forgive me if I get this wrong. But my understanding is that we have way more preservatives in our bread here. We've got bleached flour. But one thing that was striking to me the first time I did an extended stay in Europe, stayed with a friend of mine up in Norway. I went to the grocery store, which, by the way, you got to bag your own groceries, which is funny because I put everything on the counter and the clerk looked at me like I had three heads. It's just like, what are you doing? You got to bag your stuff, dude. But anyway, we bought a loaf of bread. And, I think when you're at a restaurant, you just eat the bread that comes out. You don't think about this. But if you don't eat the loaf of bread within a day or two, it gets moldy because there are no preservatives. So there's a big difference in terms of the manufacturing process or the baking process, like you said, between sort of the stuff that sits on shelves here for months and months and, nothing grows on it because it's got so much just junk in it, basically, versus something that's just maybe some flour, water, wheat, whatever the basic ingredients are, number one. But number two, I think it isn't just the bread, right? I mean, it's certainly, I think Europeans consume a fair amount of carbohydrates and they're delicious. If it's Italian pasta or a nice French baguette or whatever it is, right? It's delicious for anyone that's had an opportunity to dine over there, but they move. I mean, they're very pedestrian societies. And one of our favorite places to go is on the Amalfi Coast, a little town called Ravello, Italy, which is very steep. I mean, there's, a lot of these very steep steps and these sort of terraced, homes. And the first time we stayed over there, we were on a lemon farm, which is gorgeous. I mean, you wake up to this nice Mediterranean breeze and the smell of fresh lemons and people speaking Italian. It's just this amazing experience. But I mean, here these people are that are in their late 60s, early 70s, and they're carrying buckets of lemons that have got to weigh 30, 40 pounds each up these steep steps, going up and down, up and down. And I'm a pretty in shape guy, but like, this was really difficult to go up and down with just my own body weight. So my point is, when you look at the lifestyle of Europeans, they're mobile, they carry things, they're going to the grocery store, they're getting more fresh food, they're not going to the supermarket or Costco where they're buying, bulk for months and months, right, with all the preservatives. So I think they've got that caloric balance down. They're using fresh ingredients, and perhaps that was a bit of a windy tangent, but anyway, that's sort of my general observation.
That makes perfect sense. All right, so we got BRAI, I being intake. What is N?
So N is for nurturing. And when I say nurturing, this is everything community related. This is about cultivating healthy relationships, having accountability. And perhaps to use our European example again, I've observed these families that dine together that are multi-generational, or at least when you see the old Italian men playing bocce ball together or chess, it's very endearing. But I think something that we've gotten away from, at least in American culture, is that sense of community. And again, even though we can have these podcasts and Zoom and FaceTime and keep up with people that are far away, I think many times we're very isolated from one another and tight-knit and in-person communities because we're so busy, running from A to B to, to work, to get the kids to practice, to home, it's such a stressful life. And I think we all really need to slow down and appreciate just time together And again, when we look at the literature and we look at people who, in fact, have a shared sense of purpose and community and a close nuclear family, they tend to live longer. You know, they tend to be happier. They tend to have a better quality of life. They tend to be less stressed out. And even, you know, you look at a simple hormone like oxytocin, sort of the bonding and the safety hormone. Every time you give your loved one a hug, or even if you've got a pet or a dog that you love, and when you pet your dog, you release oxytocin. That lowers your blood pressure and helps you feel safe. And again, over time, these are very small, simple habits that I think when we dissect each one, I mean, the magnitude of effect isn't, you know, necessarily huge. But when you put it all together in a lifestyle, and these are just your habits and how you live day to day, again, over years and decades, this has a massive difference in terms of where we end up. And I mean, you and I've had that conversation previously, right? I mean, you could do all the right things and still have stress get in the way and end up, you know, having a terrible health outcome. So these things matter.
They do. As you're telling me all of these things, I couldn't help think about the wild card in all of this being the advances in medicine, particularly with gene therapy and products on the market now, like GLP-1 agonists, who they hit the market and everybody was like, I'm going to lose all this weight and still do whatever I want. But now they're starting to discover that medications like Ozempic have protective factors that actually help our brain, that actually this might be the first real longevity medicine that's hit the market. So talk to us about where you see health technology, biotechnology moving to help our brains be better and turn live longer.
Absolutely. That's a fun place to wrap up too, because chapter 10 in The Incredible Brain is the technology chapter. But yeah, I mean, I'm very optimistic about where we're headed as a society and with continued improvements in technology. And I think it's very difficult for the way our brain is designed. We're designed to think linearly. And technology, is as you know, does not progress linearly. It progresses exponentially. And so even when we measure backwards, you know, it's still difficult to get an understanding of where we're headed because of the acceleration, right, of that curve and the slope of the curve just continuing to go up and up. So, you know, where we will be in 2 years is not where we were 2 years ago, right? And where we'll be in 5 years, you know, might be more like where we were 10 or 20 years ago. It's just, it's hard to say where we land. It's very difficult for people to conceptualize that. So I think in short order, we're going to see some major advances, and we already are in the middle of that, right? I mean, you know, ChatGPT wasn't really a conversation 2 years ago, and now that's all you hear about. And of course, you know, you've got all the other LLMs, right, that compete. We've got humanoid robots, we've got, you know, wearable devices. And I mean, it's happening quickly, which is very exciting. You know, you mentioned gene therapy like CRISPR. Great. You can get rid of horrible conditions like Huntington's hopefully soon. And, you know, all these, and maybe perhaps ALS if we, you know, get that right. So anyway, we're headed in a very exciting direction. The GLP-1s are an interesting conversation too. I was initially very skeptical of these in particular. But yeah, it appears that they not only help with weight loss, but with, again, our metabolic health overall, there do seem to be some protective effects on the brain and the cardiovascular system, which is fascinating. Do I think that any drug or medication is a replacement for the right lifestyle? I don't know that we're there yet. Perhaps we will be one day and we can all just hit the easy button and get an infusion and be on with our day, which is probably what people would prefer than you know, having to put all these lifestyle habits in place. But right now, I think that gives us the best chance, certainly, to end up in a good position, you know, if and when the technology shows up that, you know, it can really make a huge impact on keeping us younger or whatever it's going to be. Because there's some interesting conversations around that for sure.
And I know keeping us younger, keeping our brains optimized, that's your focus. We mentioned that in the beginning that you founded a company called Transcend Health that does exactly that. I want to give you just a moment to shine a spotlight on Transcend Health and the work you're doing there.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So we launched Transcend Health just about a year and a half ago. And right now we really have two programs. One is our group membership. So if anybody enjoys this kind of content and they like to have a community where they want to discuss health related issues and learn more about how to protect their brain and body, that's what we have. So we meet twice a month, and we do live Zoom calls like this, and people have a little community portal where they can talk, and I post updates and articles and have all our wellness protocols. So that's been just been really fun to watch that group grow, and not only that, but transform. I mean, just watch people lose weight and feel better and sleep better and just get healthier. It's just a fun experience for me to share that with people. And then we are launching a concierge practice early next year. That's going to be probably a small audience that they were looking to have there. But again, I think the group membership may be a good place for a lot of your listeners to think about.
Outstanding. And we'll have links to that in the show notes as well. Ryan, this has been such a great conversation. Our time together has flown by. I suspected that it would. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guest a single question. And that is, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
If I could really boil it down to one thing, I really think it's that you as an individual have far more control than you think over your life, over your health, and over any health-related outcome. And there are a lot of narratives that get pushed out there that, oh, you know, my grandparents had Alzheimer's and I'm relegated to that future, or, you know, diabetes runs in my family, or whatever things you hear. And yeah, maybe there's some truth to some of those. But again, we look at the literature, the vast, vast majority of our health outcomes come down to what you do every single day, and it's your habits that matter. And you are absolutely in control of that. So I want to empower and encourage all of you to consider that and pursue it and just go live a long, healthy, impactful life.
Well said. Ryan, tell us where people can learn more about you online and the work you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for anyone interested in the book, The Incredible Brain, you just go on Amazon, just look for The Incredible Brain by Ryan Williamson. You'll find it there. But link to the book and everything else, all the memberships and everything, people just go to transcendhealthgroup.com. Transcendhealthgroup.com. That'll get you everywhere.
Perfect. And if you are working on the A being activity part of the brain acronym, we got you covered. Everything. Dr. Ryan Williamson will be linked in the show notes for this episode at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Ryan, this has been great. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I learned a lot, and I know everybody listening did too.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And to those of you listening to this, thank you as well. If you like what you heard, if you're inspired, if you're excited, if you're going to go work on those BRAIN acronyms today, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.